WLRN presents Topical Currents. For 128 Division I football teams, most have programs rarely seen on TV. But at the really big, big-time schools, football is not only a religion, but rules the roost. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Such teams as Alabama, Ohio State, Michigan, and Florida spend a shocking amount of money for facilities and coaching staffs. The 10 biggest programs took in $800 million in 2013. The college game gets generous tax breaks to sell outrageously priced seats, and their TV income was inconceivable just 10 years ago. The founder of Nike alone built his Oregon alma mater, a $68 million building, not a stadium, a player facility. Stay tuned. Topical Currents next, after the news.
And welcome to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. How was your weekend?
Very good.
Filled with college football?
Well, not too much college football. Of course, the Canes didn't play, and we won't even talk about the Miami Dolphins.
Okay. Well, just in the past decade, college football, the industry has doubled in size. The most growth and economic surge has come from the elite programs at large state schools. Think Ohio State, Michigan, Oregon, Texas, and also the Florida teams.
Some say the top schools have sold their educational souls in pursuit of big football bucks and television exposure. We'll consider these facts with investigative journalist and two-time Pulitzer Prize winner Gilbert Gahl.
He's the author of Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football.
And he's on the phone from Haddonfield, New Jersey. Welcome to you, Gilbert Gahl. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Did you watch the games on Saturday?
Sometimes. I did last Saturday. I watched a little bit, for sure, in the evening.
Okay. Well, our Saturdays are saturated. Good timing for your book. You say that there's been this rise in college football revenues, that it's doubled in size. What years are we talking about, and why did it happen? What accounts for it?
Sure. So I looked at the growth in college football for both the major programs and what I call the have-not schools, the poorer schools, for the period of 1999 through 2015. And I looked at that area in particular. I already knew the earlier history, but what you see is a sharp spike in the money coming into college football during this time period. So as far as where it comes from, there are basically four major revenue streams. First one everybody knows about, that's the television money. There's been a tremendous increase in the contracts the last round. For example, the Pac-12, which includes Oregon, UCLA, and USC, among others, signed a $3 billion deal back in, I think it was 2009 or 2010. The SEC has its own new network that is doing quite well, the Big Ten, and so on. Second major stream of money that people probably don't know about is something called seat donations. And this is where, back really in the late 70s and 80s, athletic directors at these elite programs understood there's such a demand for the seat that in addition to the regular ticket, season ticket that you buy, that they could charge you on top of that hundreds of dollars or even thousands of dollars. It goes up to as much as $20,000 a ticket. In order to secure your seat. So that's the second stream, and that accounts for hundreds of millions of dollars annually for these programs. The third one is the obvious one, tickets, the face value of the tickets, and then the fourth one is corporate money, and that's everything from Nike and Under Armour to the digital advertising that you see on the scoreboards to the licensing and marketing deals.
Did the conference jockeying that we saw a few years ago really further arm the big schools? You know, there were transitions from the Big 12, the Big 10, and also the SEC.
Sure, absolutely it did. And I mean, if you look at Texas A&M, for example, I mean, that was a money move. They saw what was happening in the Big 12 with Texas, Baylor, and the other schools, And there was a hang-up there with or infighting over what kind of television deal there would be. And they got lured away to join the SEC, which had a much more lucrative payout from that conference. So, you know, partially in response, Texas A&M has redone its stadium, Kyle Field. They just went through a $460 million or $450 million renovation and added 20,000 seats. So, yeah, all of that movement that you saw a few years ago, and you'll see a little bit more of it in the future, is all about money.
Well, let's take the number that you're talking about here a year. It's $250 billion. And you add to that that it's tax-free. So
yeah.
Let's talk about that aspect of it. I want to get back to the seats and all that, too. But how is it tax? Why is this tax-free?
Yeah. So let me just correct you there for a second. $2.5 billion.
I'm sorry. That's right.
That could start a war.
But, it's lucrative, but not quite that lucrative.
Yeah, $2.5 billion, right. Okay.
Got it. So it is tax-free in this sense. Universities are either, you know, they're land grants, they're public state-owned institutions, or else they're private, nonprofit institutions like University of Miami, right there in your neighborhood. And so because of their educational mission, historically, they haven't been taxed. You know, I mean, we want to encourage education. And athletics fell under that traditionally, including football, and it continues to this day to benefit from that. I guess if you want to call it an argument, what I'm arguing in my book is that that's great when, you know, if you go back 100 years and all of this is clearly an amateur kind of adventure at the universities, but today these are very clearly highly commercialized, monetized programs. Football is extremely profitable. It drives everything in the athletic department and accounts for far and away the most money that flows into these elite programs. Example of a for-profit business, but yet it continues to benefit from tax-exempt status. And in fact, when the IRS has tried, and it has tried several times, to tax some of these revenue streams, it has been beaten back by the college football lobby and by their friends in Congress, which have even written into law tax breaks for these programs.
Of course, it would be political suicide for some of these legislators to be, in the view of the public, hurting their college teams like in Texas and Alabama and that, my Lord.
No, that's exactly, you're spot on. That's exactly right. I mean, no legislator in his or her right mind is going to go after the dear old state university football program and say, aha, you know, you look and smell and feel like a nonprofit organization and ought to be paying taxes. Because if they did, you know, they'd be voted out in the next round of elections.
Well, let's like take what you said Texas made, I guess it was last year, $76 million.
And had a crummy season.
Yeah, I think it's probably 2013 dollars for University of Texas. And it's more like just football. I'm sure it's closer to $80 million now. And that's, if I'm remembering correctly, they probably had revenues of about $110 million that year, and about $80 million of that fell straight to the bottom line, sure.
Okay, so let's talk about where all that money goes, because we would think it goes right back into the university and everybody benefits, but that's not the case.
No, it's not the case. I mean, a lot of people mistakenly believe that these football programs are helping to subsidize academics. And the reality is that very little of the money goes to the academic side. And in fact, in some cases, no money at all goes to the academic side. What little bit does go is de minimis. It's just a tiny percentage of the dollars they take in. Where does the money go? Well, it goes to everything from, if you look at coaches' salaries, which have also spiked during this last 15-year period, and you have examples like the top 10 head football coaches in the country are earning about an average of $5 million. Nick Saban is now getting $7.1 million, and those that the arc of coaches' salaries has just gone up dramatically. And along with the head coaches I'll mention, the 9 full-time assistant coaches have benefited from that spike as well, where an assistant coach might have gotten, say, $200,000 15 years ago or $150,000. He's now getting, probably on average about $600,000 at the elite program. And, in fact, quite a few of them are getting more than $1 million.
Well, one of the highest paid coaches, though, of course, if not the highest coach, is Nick Saban of Alabama,
yeah,
who is just worshipped here in South Florida.
Oh, yeah.
Tell his story.
Except for his two years running the Dolphins,
right,
which was rather painful for him, I'm sure.
Can I just point out what you point out in your book, that sure, his $7.1 million paycheck, if you'll talk about this as well, is 12 times what the school pays its president and the equivalent of what 50 full-time professors earn for teaching and doing research, just to
right,
put it in perspective. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm interested in coaches' salaries for a bunch of reasons, beyond, just being a voyeur and saying, oh, that's a big number. It has a clear distorting effect on the university when you're paying your football coach $5 million or even $7 million. Now, I've been to Alabama. Nobody blinks an eyelash at paying Nick Saban $7 million. I will tell you that because they're obsessed with football and with their college football program, and because Saban is extremely successful. He's a very, very good college football coach. But does that mean that it's still right? And, even if it is, how do you come up with that figure? How do you negotiate that amount of money? What are the metrics that you use? Is it all based on wins and losses? Is it based on him filling up the stadium every Saturday? What are the measures that you use? And then how does that then impact the university? A full professor at Alabama is probably getting in the magnitude of $110,000, $115,000 a year now. The president, the last time I looked, is getting about $600,000 or $700,000. The governor in the state, who doesn't take the salary, by the way, I don't think, is paid something like $159,000. So clearly, what the values that you're selecting here, that you're valuing, in fact, are college football is that important in Alabama and in lots of other states.
But you add that Alabama's profit margin in football has eroded during Saban's tenure.
Well, it's gone down. I was looking at Nick Saban likes to use business terms. He's a very smart guy, and he likes to use business terms to defend his salary. He uses the phrase return on investment. You have to look at the return on investment in order to see why I'm being paid all this money. And I, in fact, went and looked at the return on investment. And if you use a pure business analysis, which I did, the profit margin under Nick Saban at Alabama has gone down fairly sharply. Now, believe me, they're by no means poor. The absolute margin is still really, really high, but it's considerably lower than it was before he arrived. And there's a simple explanation for that. Nick Saban's expensive. So when he came to Alabama, the cost of running the football program was about $16 million a year. The last year where the data were available to me, it was $41 million a year. So just in a span of about 5 years, more than doubled on the expense side. And on the revenue side, yeah, it continued to go up, but it didn't go up nearly as quickly. So hence, the profit margin goes down.
We're speaking with 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Gilbert Gahl. And by the way, he's been shortlisted for 4 other Pulitzer Prizes. He's written Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. On today's Topical Currents, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
And rah, 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 it's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We continue with Gilbert Gahl. He's written a book, Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. This book took several years of research and is extremely authoritative. Gilbert, many people will view that many of the fans will view that the college players in these big programs are taking in billions, or really the pawns and the victims of all this. They're risking their life, limb. They're risking potential NFL million-dollar contracts. But you say that really they shouldn't be looked at quite that with such what's the right word?
Well, we shouldn't feel so sorry for them after all. That
there
it's all out of whack.
There we go. It's
anyway.
Monday.
It's Monday. Okay, Gilbert.
Well, I mean, two thoughts. First one is I didn't go into the pay issue that deeply, so I had a kind of throwaway line that a number of people have picked up on, in which I said something to the effect that I wasn't quite as sympathetic to the players as I expected to be on the pay issue. Now, what I really mean by that is I don't view the players as victims. I clearly realize that they are the ones who are generating all this money. And you can make a powerful argument, as many people have, that they ought to be paid. Then the question becomes, how much are you going to pay them? And that's where I think the narrative breaks down so far. If you pay them a few thousand dollars more, what they call full cost of attending college, let's say up to $4,000 or $5,000. Now, you might pay them that annually, you might put it in a stipend, it doesn't really matter what the form is. That's not going to change anything in the model, the way the model works. It's going to continue to hum along. The schools, for the most part, are going to be able to handle that incremental increase in paying the students, the athletes. It's where the argument goes when you say, okay, you know, we're going to have something like competitive bidding for football players. So let's say there's a great quarterback in Miami who is being recruited by Miami, Florida, Florida State, and they're going to end up bidding for his services. And, you know, you might end up promising that kid $50,000 or even $100,000. And once you go to that model, then you have all kinds of issues that come into play. Is the kid an employee of the university at that point? Is he employee of the football program? Does he pay taxes? Are you going to pay him up front? Are you going to pay him, when he graduates from school in a stipend or some other form? And if you're going to compete for players like that and pay players that kind of money, it seems to me you're then finally acknowledging what football truly is at these elite schools, which is a for-profit enterprise, highly lucrative, rather large, untaxed at the moment. But if you do that, then you open up that tax question.
Of course, you have stories of some of these players. I know some of them came from UM and partly justified the Nevin Shapiro business, that some of these players who get so much attention and television exposure and bring in so much money can't afford a meal at a nice restaurant.
Well, remember when we had on Luther Campbell not long ago, and he was scandalized because he was giving money to some of the players because he said they couldn't even afford
emergencies
and family because they couldn't afford to eat. Yes, they get these scholarships, but they're not getting enough to live with their families.
Right. So the theory is that the cost of attendance money, which is being adopted even as we speak by the SEC and the other major conferences, will take care of that problem. If you're getting an additional $5,000, let's say, above and beyond your scholarship and all of the other benefits and perks that you get as a college football player, and we should talk about some of those.
We will.
In theory, that's gonna help those poor, and there are plenty of them, football players who don't have money to buy a pizza on the weekends or are going hungry or whatever. That should take care of that. The real issue, though, is once you open this door of paying the players, I really think down the line, the pressure is going to ratchet up to pay them even more. And all I'm saying is once we get to that tipping point, a whole bunch of issues come into play that aren't being really spoken about or addressed or analyzed very carefully at the moment. in the narrative. With the narrative that exists today is that the players are being victimized and we need to pay them. And I'm not opposed to that. I don't have a dog in the fight. However this turns out, it turns out. I'm just saying, okay, but let's think about what's going to happen when that occurs. Mm.
Gilbert, you have an Ivy League education. I was kind of plodding along at a former Big 8 school. But when I was in class, I was a confirmed C+, maybe B- student. But I would have had A+ if I had somebody who made sure I turned in my papers on time, that knocked on my door to make sure my rear end was out of bed and in class. And I was provide tutors for every course I took.
Right.
I could have done much better. And that's what these players are getting.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those perks and benefits now.
This is one of, first of all, it's largely unknown the extent that schools go to keep the players eligible and hopefully on track to even earn a degree. So I wrote a chapter about that in which I got a chance to go around and visit some of these programs and see what they did. In the last 20 or so years, these things called academic support centers have evolved at these elite programs, and they're rather elaborate and costly operations where you have a large facility that's exclusive for athletes, primarily football players and basketball players, because they tend to be the problem sports for the most part academically. You have tutors, you have academic advisors, you have reading and writing specialists, you have learning disabilities specialists, you even have life skills coaches, and you have these things called class checkers at a lot of schools. And that's people whose jobs are to either go knock on the door and make sure you get up to go to class, or else, as at Kansas, where I went out to follow around a class checker, they wander around the university and they wait outside the room where the students are supposed to show up and have the students sign in to make sure that they attend the class. And then that goes back to the coach, so the coach knows whether the kid's going to class or not. And some of the kids still don't go to class. But, you can look at this one of two ways. One way would be that this is a good thing. It's part of the moral responsibility that these schools have. If you're going to, if you're going to recruit somebody in, and they're going to be working 40 hours a week at football, you have a responsibility to help them academically. The other way to look at it is that this is one more sign of the extreme lengths that schools, these elite programs, have to go in order to prop up these their players, and that a lot of these players, or a significant number anyway, arrive on campus woefully prepared for an actual academic life. I mean, their SAT scores may be a standard deviation or two behind the mean, their GPAs are considerably lower, and here they are playing 40 hours a week at football and at the same time are expected to be a real student. It just doesn't work.
We've talked about the Texas, Michigan's, Ohio State's, Florida's, the big state schools. But what about the smaller ones, the Akron's, and then, say, in our own backyard, the FIUs and FAUs, making it financially?
Yeah. So, the economic model really doesn't work for schools like Florida Atlantic or FIU or Akron, Eastern Michigan, one of my favorites, New Mexico State, and I can keep going. There are 60 schools. I call them the have-not schools. These are the schools that want to play Division I football at the highest, most expensive level, but yet they don't have any television revenue or they have very little television revenue. They don't really have great fan bases. They have, they're lucky if their stadiums are half-filled for home games. They don't have enough demand that they can charge the seat donations, these mandatory payments to secure a seat on top of, the face value of the ticket. They just don't have the money coming in. They don't have the corporate money coming in. And so when you look at their financial statements, they appear to be losing millions of dollars a year playing football. At Florida Atlantic, the situation was exacerbated because they went out and built a 30,000 seat stadium that cost, if I remember correctly, $70 million, and they went out and did this while they were still losing games like crazy. one of the only ways these schools make money is by sacrificing their teams by playing Alabama, Georgia, Auburn, and schools like that. In return for a big loss, they end up being paid, for sake of argument, $1 million for that game. But FAU went and built a new stadium. They've had trouble attracting fans during Boca Raton, and probably the students go to the beach instead of going to the games, and they don't have a large enough alumni base, and the team's been losing a lot over the years, so that doesn't help. So they have this gigantic stadium that they're still having to pay off, with a very tiny fan base. And that's not at all uncommon across these kinds of schools. Akron built a $60 million stadium that's also half empty.
Well, just let me ask you, Gilbert, who's paying for those losses at the schools that aren't making $70 million a year?
Student fees?
I'm sorry, what do you mean who's paying for the losses? The university. The university's paying for losses. They're, they charge the other students athletic fees that are embedded in the tuition. Mm. And at some of these schools, if you look, I don't remember Florida Atlantic's off the top of my head, but I'm sure it's significant. In the MAC conference, of which Akron is a member, it's not at all uncommon to see, between $15 and $20 million in athletic fees charged to the undergraduate population. Half of the time, they don't even know they're being charged to subsidize the money losing football team, and that's a significant issue. I think if I was going to make one prediction, it would be that issue is going to explode in the next few years when students figure out what they're paying for. Because of tuition itself going through the roof, and students graduating with, I think on average now, what is it, $3,000 in debt when you graduate mm-hmm. from a public university,
and it's so, tacked onto their student loans, so they're paying interest on those debts.
Well, I didn't actually think of that. That's a good point. So it keeps giving and giving.
Right. We're speaking with Gilbert Gahl. Did you want to add something? We just need to take a little break. You can say something.
No, now. I'm good.
Okay. He's written Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. Lots more questions. We'll come back and take your calls and emails as well. Stay with us.
And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also Pulitzer Prize winner Gilbert Gahl. We're talking about his book called Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, we have two more segments, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, it's a little quicker, radio@WLRN.org.
So I want to go to the issue of college presidents in all of these cases where the have-nots are losing so much, which is being, made up for by the students, and where the ones that have, the money's going directly into the athletic department and not into the university. Why are college presidents not doing anything?
There's a long history with the presidents. One of the things you see is that, let me step back for a second. I mean, the quick history here is that they've been concerned about football for one reason or another almost since its inception. People were killed or were injured playing football in the beginning days. They were concerned about that. It wasn't long before academic fraud and cheating occurred, and they were concerned about that. One of the things I did was I went back and read 40 years worth of reports that the presidents, either directly or indirectly, were responsible for putting out about college football, expressing their concerns about it, and college spending on athletics generally. And what you see is that almost every other year a report comes out in which they're saying things like, spending is out of control. Athletic spending is out of control. Spending on football is out of control. We really, truly need to do something about it. And you track these reports up until about 2011, when the most recent one came out, in which they basically threw up their hands and said, this is a mess, but guess what? we feel like we can't do anything about it ourselves. We need somebody to help us. Problem is, there's really nobody to help them. Congress isn't going to step in. They're deep in bed with the college football lobby, and you know, these elite programs, they're not about to go after them. The NCAA actually has very little control over college football. It doesn't control the money flows to college football, so, you know, they don't have a tremendous amount of power. So it really comes back to the presidents themselves, and this is where it gets so frustrating, I think, from the outside, you know, why you don't see more presidents standing up to what's going on with football and to the distortions that it causes. I'll give you a really quick example. Rutgers is going through a problem right now where they booted six players off of the team for allegedly house break-ins and stealing. Well, that problem started in the academic side with the football coach lobbying an adjunct professor to try to see if there was something to get the grade changed for one of the star players who I guess was failing the course or whatever. I mean, this goes on and on and on, and the president just keeps saying, you know, we'd like to fix it, but we don't know how.
Of course, one of the presidents lost his job over the Sandusky affair at Penn State, and it really hardly made a blip on their attendance or revenue.
Well, that's not exactly true. I mean, first of all, I think the Sandusky case is an outlier in the sense that it's not really about academic fraud. It's about this predator. Really egregious example. They did have an effect. I mean, their attendance went down, and I'm not sure that you can attribute all this to the Sandusky scandal because it was also the economy. They were also raising their ticket prices, but their attendance went down for about 2 years, possibly three, by almost 10,000 fans or 10,000 seats in a, I think their stadium is 106,000.
Oh, yeah.
So there was, there was some impact, and financially, for a brief period of time, you saw the impact on the bottom line. Their revenues actually went down. The last financial statement I looked at for Penn State, however, it looked to me like they had more or less stabilize the revenue side of their program. And clearly they want to go right back to being a major football power because they agreed to hire James Franklin from Vanderbilt, where he had been the head coach for 3 years and done an okay job, and they agreed to pay him, $4.3 million. I was sort of stunned by that because Joe Paterno, when he was the head coach at Penn State all those years, claimed that the highest salary he ever was paid at Penn State was $1 million. And here they were paying Franklin $4.3 million. So that says a lot about, what Penn State wanted to achieve or hoped to achieve and how much they were willing to spend for it.
How has it come to pass that in many of these coaches' cases is they do better financially after they're fired a few times than if they stay on the job?
Well, yeah. I already told you. I mean, I was interested in this whole question of is there a real marketplace for coaches, or are the coaches basically writing their own tickets here with their agents? I think it's the latter. I was interested in that, and as part of looking at that, I looked at the buyouts for coaches. I ended up focusing on the buyout for Charlie Weiss, who was the head coach at Notre Dame. He was hired, I think it was in 2004. They gave him a six-year deal, and then six games into the very first season he's coaching, they tear up the contract and extend it for 10 years, guaranteed. I mean, that was just, wow. That was just unbelievable. And, he did okay his first couple of years, but then it went south, and Notre Dame ended up firing him, and I forget how many years were left on the contract, but let's say it was five. They owed him a boatload of money. It was somewhere in the magnitude of $17 million, and then Charlie Weiss eventually went to Kansas 2 years later and became the head coach at Kansas, which is not much of a football school, and after he had a five-year deal there, and after 2 years, and I think it was three games, he was fired there. And Kansas owed him, I think it was $5.5 million. So when it was all said and done, it appears as if he was owed $23 million or was being paid $23 million, essentially, not the coach.
Again, our number, if you have a question or a comment for Gilbert Gaul, who's written Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, radio@WLRN.org. Do you think it's distorted the academic mission of universities? We do have an emailer. Patrick wants to know how ESPN changed the playing field of college football now with more and more options other than pay television. How will 3.2 million people dropping pay television affect college football?
Yeah, those are really good questions. It's the disruptive impact of technology, which I thought a little bit about. I'm not an expert on technology, but there's a real risk down the line of if you go to a la carte and people, you know, drop, people who don't watch college football but who are currently forced under the contracts with Comcast and Verizon or whoever, you know, basically to pay that large fee, drop it, you know, then there's an issue of revenue on that piece of it. So that's a potential threat. I think also the younger generation is seems to be less interested in college football than their parents and grandparents, and I think it's because they're distracted with technology. You know, they have all these devices in their hands and are constantly fiddling with them. So that's a potential threat. You've seen a number of examples of students now either not going to the games or leaving games early, including at Alabama, of all places. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, in part, at least, because of technology. So there's that. Now, on the flip side of the question, I'm not an expert on ESPN, but it's clear that ESPN has completely rewritten the landscape of college football by being willing to pay gigantic sums of money in return for live content. And some of the contracts, the recent contracts, that Pac-12 contract for $3 billion, the SEC contracts, setting up the SEC network, you know, the other conference deals, are just extraordinary. I don't think that the next round of contracts will be nearly as lucrative as the last one. But, you know, I'm willing to admit I don't know that for sure, and I could easily be wrong.
Well, we'll see. We're speaking with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Gilbert Gaul about his latest book, Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. We'll be right back.
And it is Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Gilbert Gaul. Investigative journalist. He's the author of Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. We have about 10 or 11 minutes left. If you'd like to call, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Gilbert, very concisely, could you tell us how women's rowing became such a big sport in college athletics?
Concisely, yeah, I'll try. And I was looking at data, and what I saw was an explosion in the number of women rowers at these elite football schools, these 65 schools in the five so-called power conferences. And it occurs between 95 and the year 2000. Now, there have always been some women rowers, primarily at elite Ivy League schools or on the West Coast at places like Cal Berkeley or out at Wisconsin, which has a long, proud history. But there's this gigantic increase. It goes from roughly 1,800 women's rowers in these D1 schools to nearly 5,000. The number of programs doubles from 44 to, you know, something like 85. So I looked at that, and I thought to myself, wow, isn't this interesting? And I went and you know, did my reporting, and what I found was that in 95, in that time period, these football schools had a problem, and the problem was that football had grown so large and so rich, the squads were so big, and there was nothing remotely close in terms of a sport for women, so they needed they needed a new sport that they could get a large body count of women to offset those football squads. And they discovered women's rowing. It's relatively cheap. You know, you buy a bunch of eights, some fours, and a couple pairs. The coaches pay a fraction of what a football coach is paid. You need a little bit of water, and you're off and running, or rowing. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, it was all about Title IX, gender equity, offsetting the football numbers.
We have an emailer. Part of the drive of the demand for big-time D1 football and basketball is to enable the massive alumni bases of these schools to follow en route for their alma mater. Engagement with alumni without sports is difficult, which is why so many people pay the donation premiums for tickets and travel across the country to follow their teams. It's a source of immense pride. I went to a D3 small school and did not have big-time athletes. This is Mike. Speaking of engagement, sports gambling and the new boom of daily fantasy is impacting amateur and professional football this fall. How does the professor, Gilbert Gall, think about gambling fantasy's impact on the size of the college sports industry? And does he think sports gambling will become legal like daily fantasy? And what will the revenues for college football be?
I noticed yesterday every break on the football games had a fantasy football
spot.
Yeah,
they did. I noticed it too.
Yeah, that's totally annoying, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, how is that not gambling? But actually, there was a pretty good article in the Times that argued why it isn't gambling. That made sense to me. I don't remember it, but anyway, I don't know. I'd be blue skying it to say whether this will come to college football. I mean, if it does, it's not going to come immediately, but it would be as we go a little farther down line, whether that's 10 or 20 years, to a model in which basically we. You know, the schools are operating the equivalent of semi-pro teams over here on the side. Then it wouldn't matter whether you had this kind of fantasy gambling going on. But the NCAA, for the moment, will continue to argue that, you know, really this is all an amateur athletic experience, which is just insane on its face, but yet they still argue that. And so, you know, they're going to fight it.
And did you want to take that call, Joe?
Okay. Al in Miami, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to tell you that just last week, a friend of mine, he and I went to the University of Texas in Austin together, and he put up a post on Facebook that said, at the University of Texas, and I don't know if it's all the schools over there, if it's just UT, I don't know, but we're going to start charging the schools, for the seats that marching band players take up at $100 a pop. And, you know, and he, my friend, is actually a former Longhorn band member, and he said, I will not be going to any more games as long as that fee is in place.
I haven't heard that one, but you know what? Nothing would surprise me at this point in time. And things are in such flux at Texas with firing the AD and the football program struggling for a number of years and everything that's going on there. Nothing would surprise me. The fan base there is quite different. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. That's putting it mildly.
Yes.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have an emailer, Gilbert, who says, $5,000 for a top quarterback, LOL. It should be whatever the market bears for the players.
That's right.
Absolutely, the cost would go up for colleges, but so what? To defend the status quo while being unfair to the ones generating the revenue is unfair. It's like saying that slavery should not have ended because it upset the economic structure that made certain people wealthy. Certain people are benefiting economically from college football and basketball, and they're not even taking the risks. Granted, there's a difference between a slave and a player, and certain people are just extremely lucky that players like to play and compete. There's a legitimate question as to whether colleges and universities should even be involved in the football and basketball business. They should not under the current economic structure. That's from Al.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with Al's analysis at all, and I think we've said this earlier in our conversation. The only thing I'm adding to the analysis is, if we do go that route, let's understand what's going to happen. What you know, what the implications are. And a number of them are tax implications, that if, you know, you start paying a player $10,000 or $15,000 or $50,000, you know, the issues, again, are they employed? Do they pay taxes? Is it a business? Et cetera, et cetera. And once you begin to, if you are going to tax that business, then the model that exists now becomes, if not threatened, it certainly becomes challenged. So there are other implications. So, for example, if you take all of the other sports, the so-called Olympic sports like field hockey and soccer and swimming and whatnot, and do you then throw them back inside the university and treat them the way we used to treat them as real amateur sports?
Right.
That could happen. There are all kinds of things that, that get put in play when you go to that model. That's my only point. I don't care whether it happens or it doesn't happen.
In the big-time schools, you know, we've been talking about the Floridas, Tennessees, Alabamas, yeah, and such, they're such a huge squad. There's like 125 players. And, of course, there are walk-ons on that squad, but do any of the walk-ons in the big-time programs play?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it's not a huge number, but occasionally, I mean, and you read about this all the time, but, you know, occasionally one of them will make the team and then qualify for a even qualify for a scholarship.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the numbers well enough to say it's X percent. My guess is it's a small percent. So in effect, however many walk-ons, and there's probably not that many as you might think at those programs, but, you know, what happens to the rest of them? Do they just play because they like to play? Do they end up basically sacrificing their bodies to the first team during practice? I don't know.
I'm wondering, with all this, the tutorials and the guidance that these players get, is there any information? I'm not talking about the ones that go on to the NFL, that are drafted into the NFL. Is there information about how these players fare down the road? I mean, they've had a great education now, and do they succeed?
That you're asking, in my opinion, the most important question that needs to be answered, and this goes right back to the NCAA. It's on them. So what I'm thinking about and have even suggested is that there needs to be a study that looks at, let's take 1 year's worth of football players and then let's track them out 10 years and go find out what happened to them. Did they graduate? Did they get a useful degree? Are they using that degree in life? Do they have some other kind of meaningful job? Are they working as a security guard? You know, are they not working at all? Are they broke? Are they alive? I mean, that information needs to be known.
Right, because the scholarships that they get are what, 10 times what the academic scholarships are?
Well, at a lot of schools they are.
And, yeah.
You know, in that sense, that's why when I say I'm a little less sympathetic than I thought I might be, I mean, look, the value of a scholarship is meaningful, of an athletic scholarship. And if you use it, you have a chance to graduate debt-free. And that doesn't offset the fact that you're still generating all that money and you probably ought to get a little bit more of it. But it's still, you know, an incredible value. But how are people using it? And oftentimes, you know, a lot of them aren't using it, or they're getting a useless degree, or they're not even getting a degree.
Well, that remains to be seen. If they're going to start tracking that, maybe with this book they will. Gilbert Gahl is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He's been shortlisted for the Pulitzer 4 other times over the span of 35-year career. He's worked for the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, among other publications. And he's written Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. Really interesting book. Thank you, Gilbert.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Our pleasure.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow, Bonnie and I will be in our At Your Service program mode. We'll do our pet care call-in program with veterinarian Dr. Ian Kupke and animal behaviorist Adele Miedes.
Can't wait for that.
We'll also address the emotional support animal controversy as well.
Versus the service dogs, right?
Right. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.